Let's take the compliance presentations.
Thank you, Chair.
I suppose it's going to be brief. And
yes, I will. I'll keep it very brief. I understand that there have been presentations on compliance and enforcement here before, so I think we were asked to specifically come and give feedback on some of the enforcement actions. I think that within the air quality space, one needs to understand that it does become quite tricky in terms of what is the role of compliance and enforcement at the national office, because air pollution is focused at the local authority level. They are the licensing authority, and therefore when these postponement decisions are made, the standards get put back into the atmospheric emission licenses, and that becomes the focus of the local authority compliance and enforcement activities. So I think I just wanted to touch very briefly on some of the initiatives. I think there were specifically, if we go through the presentation, particular sites where you would like us to give you feedback on what enforcement action has been taken. So what we have done over the years, and I think with regard to air quality, it's been particularly challenging. I think when the Air Quality Act came out, I think as compliance and enforcement officials, we were quite excited. But then, of course, there are these time frames for coming into compliance. So you would go to a site, you would pick up non-compliance, but then there would be processes within which these facilities could either ask for postponements or they only needed to comply with standards within certain times. So you would be involved in an enforcement action already, and then the situation would change and you would need to start again. So I think over the years we have looked at how do we bring people into the regulatory net, how do we ensure compliance and do enforcement through administrative notices, directives, etc., where you're not shutting down facilities and you're ensuring that there is social and economic growth within the country. There's a lot of historical pollution issues when it comes to air quality, a lot of outdated technology. So if you are taking people to court and criminally prosecuting them, that doesn't necessarily actually improve the situation. And then, of course, there's complex science and a lot of technical specialization that we require if you want to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case that they were intentional about what they did and that they were the contributor to whatever impacts have happened. It becomes quite difficult within the environment that Thule mentioned just now, where you're not sure exactly who's contributing to what impacts. So over the years, I know that we have presented before in terms of the baseline inspections, where we did focus in on specific sectors such as the refineries, ferroalloy industry, the cement industry, and then specific areas, so a lot of the ESCOM plants we've been to before, where we then had plans, we did compliance variation, we looked at how they could move into compliance, and then we would go back and do follow-up inspections just to see if there's continued non-compliance, and then how do we deal with that? Is it through compliance notices? Is it through criminal investigations, etc.? So this is just the background. Obviously, with regard to these air quality issues, as I said, we would team up with the provincial environmental management inspectors, as well as those inspectors sitting at the local authority level who are primarily responsible for this compliance and enforcement. And then we would also obviously look at a lot of the reporting that the facilities themselves did, and that reporting obviously goes back through to the licensing authorities. So I just wanted to remind us about what it says in the Constitution around our concurrent competency. As I said, this focus area remains with the local authority, but we need to obviously support them. So there is quite a lot of work that is done in terms of trying to support both provinces and local authority to be able to do the work themselves. This just gives you a sense over the years. We have a project to really focus on designating environmental management inspectors at a local authority level. At the end of the 16-17 financial year, we had 303 local authority EMIs, and that number will increase progressively now in 17-18. We're actually in the middle of our compliance and enforcement Lekgotla and had a whole session yesterday on local authority EMIs and how we can build additional capabilities to be able to, in particular, do compliance and enforcement around air quality. The compliance status then, I was told that I needed to look at some of the work that we've done since April 2015. And the on-site inspections that had been undertaken by our compliance colleagues within the Chief Directorate Compliance, where they then visited 21 facilities in these joint inspections. A total of 16 were not seen in full compliance to the emission standards. And you can see those were 5 ESCOM power stations, 5 healthcare risk waste facilities, and 6 other various facilities. And those were based on certain sectors that we had prioritized at the time. And then you can see we also had a blitz at that time on the healthcare risk waste sector, which is why you'll see that there are facilities there. I'd mentioned old technologies and poor quality of coal is obviously one of the reasons for non-compliance that ESCOM raises. Reports of non-compliance were then shared with the line functions, and we can never make a decision in terms of what enforcement action to take in the absence of the licensing authority, the local authority, understanding the issues, understanding whether people have applied for postponements, have those postponement decisions been granted, etc. And then also there are issues between what is coming out of air quality and also where it is waste that is actually being incinerated. So particularly around the healthcare risk waste facilities, there's a waste issue, and therefore we need to engage with our waste line function as well before we take action. That was just a slide that provides a bit of an indication. We love acronyms, so that just shows you what we mean by a lot of the next few slides. But then in terms of the enforcement status, and as I said, it is in terms of inspections that were done since April 2015, so you can see there in terms of PPC Dwaalboom, where the inspection happened in September 2015, there was enforcement action that was then taken around the exceedances in PM, where pre-compliance notice was issued, representations came through where they then indicate plans to come into compliance, and no further enforcement action was then taken because the new AEL was issued, and it makes it very difficult if you're trying to move into particularly criminal enforcement, and then the prosecutor say, but now you've got a new atmospheric emission license, and therefore they are now in compliance, whereas before they were not in compliance, so is this really something that we should be taking seriously? ESCOM Tatuka, you can see we did issue pre-compliance notice there. What we then did is, based on the representations that we received, we issued what we call a Section 31H NEMA notice, which is the notice that compels the facility to give us certain information. Further representations were received, and obviously we need to go through quite a significant amount of information, understand whether there is intention and negligence behind the information that we receive, engage with the line function to decide if further action is required in terms of enforcement, or whether those plans around the postponements are things that would be able to be monitored and bring the facility into compliance. Kendall Power Station, similarly, a pre-compliance notice was issued with representations being submitted, timeframes provided to come into compliance within the 3-4 years. Everest Highveld Steel, this had been a facility that we had dealt with over a significant number of years. You can see back 2010, we gave a little bit of a history. There had been notices issued to this facility. Follow-up inspections had been done in June 2015. Pre-compliance notices, criminal investigations, and then the plant actually shut down due to business rescue. They were never going to come into compliance. And I'll give a little bit more information on future slides on this facility. Natref, pre-compliance notices issued, representations received, and then obviously Vumile also spoke about the postponement decisions. Sasselberg, similarly, there were notices that were issued in this case. We also needed to engage with our waste colleagues due to the fact that it is waste that is being incinerated in this case, and we're just waiting to see whether a decision needs to be made around enforcement action there. AMSA Funderbale Park, again, there's waste issues that we have to deal with, and we are in the process of making a decision around how to take that one forward. There was a criminal investigation that had started, and we just need to engage with the prosecutor a bit further and understand which direction to take in relation to that one. DMS Powders, similarly engaging with our waste line function. ESCOM Letabo, you can see that there was a 31H notice that was issued, and we are in the process of finalizing administrative action in that case. And Majuba as well, we're just waiting to make a decision on that one. ESCOM Medupi Power Station. Similarly, our waistline function will provide some guidance in that respect. Then we move into the healthcare risk waste processes. This one is in enforcement action, that is a Verda Klerksdorp, where notices have been issued and a final notice is on its way. Biomed, similarly, it had been referred, decisions have been made, and administrative enforcement is being taken there. Similarly with clinics, these are all healthcare risk waste types of facilities where they obviously have air quality impacts. We've also now issued notices to EnviroServe East and Cape Ruddeport, and Optimum. There are also notices that are being drafted in enforcement action taken there. Then there were a couple of slides just to give you a bit more of information with regard to some of these. So ESCOM Kendall is one, and just understanding the amount of information that comes through in terms of representations, particularly to our pre-notices. You know, there's significant plans that they provide to us in terms of how they're going to come into compliance, the reasons why they may be out of compliance. Obviously, a lot of these representations are also information that is put in terms of those postponement applications. And then the decision is, do you then, those decisions are made, but from an enforcement perspective, is there further enforcement that needs to be taken in light of that, particularly where those postponement decisions are made, and they can then comply with those standards. ESCOM Letabo, again, just giving you a sense of how we moved through these processes from 2009, when inspection reports are first issued to the facilities, into the follow-up inspections, into the enforcement action that is then taken, and then into the new inspection that happened in July 2016. And again, we are in the process of taking enforcement action, as I said, on Letabo. NatRef, similarly, it just really gives you a sense of all the information that we get in those representations, how much money the facilities undertake to spend on the equipment and the new processes that they need to do in order to come into compliance. And then obviously we need to then track those, but do we at that stage take enforcement action, or do we then allow them to do what they need to do and then take enforcement action when those things are not done at the point in time when they're not done? Sasselberg, similarly, it gives you the enforcement action that was taken in 2016-17 with the pre-notices, and then the way in which they've come back to us, and again there's an important decision we now need to make based on the fact that there was a postponement decision. How do we move forward? Is there a compliance notice that is required? Those incinerators have been shut down based on the pre-notice, but moving forward, what happens to the waste that was burnt in those incinerators? Will there then be non-compliance to waste regulations as opposed to the air quality? Clinics, again, it is a healthcare risk waste facility. It was through the blitz that we came across these, and there is administrative enforcement action to bring them into compliance. The criminal investigations, Vumile mentioned AEL Mining Services. This is not a mine. This is actually, they manufacture explosives at this facility. So part of the High Salt and Vol air quality priority, there was a blitz. A search warrant was executed, so we moved into criminal enforcement action quite quickly in relation to them. And in terms of the criminal case, the docket was submitted to the Director for Public Prosecutions, and there was an agreement there on the diversion of charges based on quite a significant fine that was paid by this company, and then they then got their postponement decision. And I think what is quite important is we're going to use the money that money was paid over to the department in terms of procuring a mobile air quality station that will actually allow us to provide additional capability to the local authorities and be able to move that monitoring station around so that we as government and regulators don't need to rely on the information that is also obviously be given to us by the facility. And further criminal investigation that we're busy with is the Sappi Cycle site down in KwaZulu-Natal. We are still, there is still further investigation that is happening in relation to this particular case, and then the docket will be handed over to the DPP's office for a decision. It had been referred initially in March, but then there was further investigation that we needed to do. As I said, Everest High Salt Steel, this was a very problematic facility within the Witbank area that we had done enforcement over a number of years, both criminal and administrative enforcement. They have shut down. Witbank looks like a different place when you drive past there these days. And that criminal case is with the DPP's office awaiting a decision. There have been various engagements between the different accused, including Evraz, which is the Russian company, with the prosecutor in this case, and we're still awaiting to see how that one is going to play out, let's say. Challenges in relation to compliance and enforcement. I think we are operating within a very difficult environment at the moment within South Africa, particularly around these big industries. There's a lot of business rescue processes. Vumele also mentioned Vanchem. There's been a couple of others as well. It makes it very difficult to move into enforcement action against these companies when they can't actually even continue to operate and pay their people in terms of keeping their jobs, etc. But we try and balance that. We try and do the enforcement at the same time putting pressure on them to come into compliance where they are impacting significantly on the environment. Building and retaining compliance and enforcement specialized experience. I think with regard to, we deal with enforcement across all areas of environmental crime, and I think with regard to the air quality issues, it is particularly complex. I think, you know, as soon as you move into criminal investigation, you have to have your experts, you've got other experts saying these impacts are not having an impact on the communities, and you obviously need to move very carefully forward in terms of that and have all your ducks in a row. And it can be quite difficult, particularly in this time that we're in at the moment where there are postponement decisions being made. You need to be consistent. You need to be uniform in the approach that you take to enforcement. At the same time, you need to enable growth and development. And, of course, then there is this overlapping mandates. So if the local authorities who are responsible for doing compliance and enforcement here are not able to do it, they need to elevate it to the province, and then the province needs to elevate it to us. And collectively, we then obviously try and make a decision about which priority areas and which focus areas as the national EMIs do we then need to focus on. There's the transitional provisions that I've spoken about, which have made it quite difficult to do compliance and enforcement in these years. Staggered time period for compliance with standards, lengthy processes. We're obviously dealing with those old dirty technologies, and then the capacity issue. And we understand that there is a major capacity issue with doing compliance and enforcement at local level. So where are we now? Within the 2017-2018 financial year, there is additional work required. Together with our line function, we are looking at those roadmaps, as Vumile mentioned. We particularly in the last quarter of this financial year, having a look at those facilities that were denied those postponement decisions, you know, to really focus in on whether there's some enforcement action that we might need to do in relation to those. There's also the apportionment study in the Vaal and Highveld priority areas. And again, that is looking at who's actually contributing, who's having that impact on the environment where we can then focus our compliance and enforcement activities. And that study for us is quite critical in order to guide the work that we do into the next year. And then, as I said, assisting and capacitating our local authorities. We don't get, as national, a lot of referrals from the local authorities saying, please come and help us do this enforcement within this particular area. So we obviously rely, you know, complaints coming in, we rely on our proactive work to focus our prioritization at this stage. Thank you, Chair. I tried to keep as brief as possible.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think you did justice to the slides. So it's now time for us to engage, and I must thank all the presenters. I would want to make a suggestion that members can pose questions, make comments, but we should not be exhaustive, because there is still a presentation by the NGOs Tomorrow we're expecting presentation by two of the big industries. So we will still continue to pose questions as we move along. There might be issues that have not come out very clear, which may come out very clear when either ESCOM, SASOL, or the NGOs are presenting. So I'm saying you must not exhaust all your bullets now. If you do have bullets, you must spare some for even later today or tomorrow. But I don't know whether the prof has got some time limits, whether he needs to leave early. Oh, okay, so we still have some time. Okay, Honorable Khadebe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will only pose three questions with your request. The first one, Chairperson, will be to know the department's take on the cost-benefit analysis of the postponement, which according to the presentation will result to the net present value of, or to a loss of 166 billion. What will be the department's take on that? And the second one, Chairperson, I would like to solicit a view from the Prof. There was a report that was tabled by Groundwork on the 28th of May 2014. According to that report, Groundwork argued that optimal pollution abatement is a must. In that report, it also said that ESCOM claims that retrofitting their entire fleet to reduce pollution will cost 200 billion. And if the, according to the Groundwork, if the ratio of 1 to 25 ratio is applied, this will mean that the government will have to save about 5,000 billion in health care costs. That money could be used, or it can be directed to early childhood development or increasing the rates of electrification. What would be the prof remarks on that? I see disputing what the Groundwork report is saying. The last one, Chairperson, is my concern regarding the stance that is taken by the department, especially when the postponement when they allow further postponement to industries. According to me, it's setting a very bad precedent. What will stop any industry to come and ask for further postponement? I think the department needs to be consistent and ensure that there will be compliance and no further postponement will be granted. That's my concern, Chairperson. Because now we are going to a stricter ones from 2020 onwards. So if they are entertained with this further postponement at this point, I think we are setting a very bad precedent. That will be the three questions for me to and comment.
Okay. Honorable Tunu.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for all the presentations. Chair, with regards to the Prof's report, in the conclusion, he says that enforcement of new plant emission standard is not necessarily the most economic method to reduce ambient exposure. This is contrary to the view or the stance that is taken by the department. I just want him to maybe elaborate on why is it that he has a different view on this one. Yeah. Secondly, I was happy with the way that all presentations were outlined, but then when looking at this one, which was by the lady, I think it lacked a bit of flesh, because with these you also take them home so that you can, you know, digest everything. It cannot be an all slide without explanation, like you have to take it from here, whatever it is explained. Yes, keys were provided with colors, but for me, really, a little bit of detail, and then she can expand on that with regards to what is meant by each of the areas. For instance, we have been given three priority areas that are national key priority areas for pollution, whatever you call it in your terms. I would have liked maybe a little bit of, because in other provinces as well, as it is mentioned in your presentation where you're explaining in details in terms of applications for postponement, one would be of the view that maybe others as well would be taken as a priority. Maybe a criteria that was used could be a little bit explained in that regard, because we do have other areas where there is mining and industries highly polluted because of the activities taking place in those areas. Yeah. For the last one on the presentation of Professor, in the summary of air quality management process, again, your bullet number 4 and 5, you're saying that we need to prioritize source reduction measures and also implement the reduction plan. I just want to know, for interest's sake, whether maybe in the research that has been conducted, I understand fully the importance of these measures or standards, but I just want to know its link, or how in the research that you have conducted, doesn't it have an impact on job opportunities, because you will find that because of what now we're doing, while implementing the standard, does it not affect employment opportunities for those working there? I just want to get an understanding. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Paddy.
Thank you, Chair. I have some comments and questions. But my first concern that jumps out at me and is a big red light is whether the metros and the district municipalities have got the capacity for this. We've spoken about it before, but you know, for issuing AELs and compliance, the capacity to monitor compliance and the enforcement. I don't believe they have, but if someone could just explain specifically for the high priority areas, whether that capacity is there or if it's not. Let's be honest. Number two, I just want to understand the National Air Quality Officer. I'm not sure of what sort of team you have behind you. You know, is there a committee, a board, or how do you work? I'm just like some clarity for that. And then if someone could answer the different targets for different units, and I'm going to use the SO2, for example, when we had all these reasons, and you know, there's SO2, this limit we've limited to 70 SO2, but then across the page some other unit is limited to 1,800. Now I'm struggling to understand why one unit is limited to 70, one to 1,800, and different NOx levels for different units, which vary greatly. So if someone could explain that, please.
Okay, Honorable Mokubele.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks for the presenters. Chair, just the first to the professor. In the almost the conclusions, the on the proposals in bullet 3, where you highlighting their strategy to address air pollution in dense, low-income settlements, that it should be prioritized, and probably it could reduce the impact more than following the what I would call the major emitters in the ambient air, probably because the air they are exposed to, it's not necessarily the one that it's very low in their own houses and so on and so on. I think that argument has been there. It depends on where you're sitting. Industry or big business will largely want to push the blame to the working class or to people generally who may be poor and so on. Poor people may be saying our health standards are impacted upon by what the big industry is doing and so on and so on. I think that argument remains. But I thought when you say let's prioritize this other one, perhaps you may need to elaborate a little bit so that we are sure whether there is a case. Yes, their stakes may be high, their air may end up elsewhere, may not necessarily impact on those local persons. But generally, for instance, if I were to use my own understanding, you find in most cases people come to a particular industry healthy, because they want healthy persons to be employed, but by the time they leave that industry, they are actually sick and they are not needed anymore. Is the argument to say that they got sick because of their own burning in the houses and so on, not necessarily from their workplace and so on? I'm just saying, if you were to elaborate so that we are able to either assist that cause ourselves, and I might have used a very simple kind of an example in that regard. The second one, to the department, particularly as you consider postponements and so on, each unit, every pollutant and so on and so on, to grant or decline those applications. And I'm focusing on yourselves, whether you do have that technical capacity in abundance to be able to do all of this. For instance, to go to the extent of saying that we declined this particular application because we thought, I'm giving an example, perhaps even quoting yourselves as you were presenting Bumila and so on, to say that we declined this because we thought, in your view, this could have been improved if the company or the industry had maintained their own facilities. I'm just giving that example. Whether you are able to go to that extent to know or understand that this was just a cause or consequence of a lack of either maintenance or whatever, whether you have all of that. The last point, in terms of the compliance and enforcement, particularly of the local authorities who issue these licenses, and the challenges that you have thereafter. It's like most of these cases with the last slides, they are not winnable in a court of law. Perhaps if we had known how many were there and how many have we been able to win and so on. But without going into those details of the actual cases, if an authority issues a license and they can't monitor whether industry complies with it or not, or themselves may be lacking or be found wanting in terms of technical or expertise to deal with that, or they may not even interpret what is being done by industry to the extent that they can believe anything what they are being told by the industry, particularly where the monitoring stations may not even be functioning. If we then want to enforce on the basis of what are we doing, that if local authorities are not the ones informing you at a national level, for instance, if you say there are no referrals, what you're doing is based on your own initiatives, meaning that locals are not assisting you that much, but they are the ones who are issuing licenses. Does it mean they issue licenses, bring them to you, then you run with their licenses and enforce them? I'm just saying, if you could explain that linkage there, how then the authority has issued and now the one who enforces you and not the authority that issued the license. Chief, if it's not clear, perhaps after the response, I would know how to, the dimension which I may still pursue after you had responded. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll start with Prof, then the department. But just something from my side, Prof. You'll comment on this one, but it does appear from myself that the study that you were sharing with us, the results, does not significantly consider the health impacts of air pollution. I saw it talks to the economics and the money that should be spent to attend to air pollution. And the health consideration are the overriding consideration in terms of us trying to attend to the issue of air pollution. I don't know what would you say to that, because it's a concern to me. We had a colloquium, I think, last month or so, where we had one of the participants sharing with us the study around the health impacts. And it's quite clear that the health impacts are great, are very high, and it's a matter that we need to attend to urgently. And I was just wondering whether such an important consideration did not find expression in your study. I don't know what you have to say to that. And the minimum emission standards, which is a tool that has been agreed, it must be used to attend to the problem. And if the argument is that we should not, or government should not insist on compliance with that, then it waters down the whole essence of having legislation. Because we know without legislation, this thing cannot be voluntary. Industry and those who pollute would not voluntarily reduce the emissions. It has to be legislated. So I wonder what you have to say to that. And maybe I must just ask my questions to all, everybody. On the trends, there is a criticism that ever since the introduction or the declaration of the priority areas some years back, and the Highveld one I think was declared in 2007. I can't remember the Vaal one, when was it declared? And now there's a Waterberg one. Now, ever since the declaration of the Highveld priority areas, which was intended to make sure that there is focus in those areas to reduce the levels of pollution, nothing much has happened. Nothing much in a sense that the pollution levels have not come down significantly. So that the declaration itself has not really yielded any positive results in a sense that not much has happened in the priority area. So the question is, what was the intention of the declaration in the first place, if since 10 years down the line not much has happened? So what is the view of the department in relation to that critique? On the applications received, the submission is that the Act allows 5-year extension or postponement, or maximum of 5 years. But I was looking here, requested applications up to 2031. Which have been granted. Now my question is, what gives the department authority to give extension up to 2031? And you'll correct me if I'm wrong, because I see it here in the pack. Compliance status with postponements. Just on ESCOM, all the power stations, April 2020 to 2031. I'm subject to correction if I'm wrong here, but I see 2031. So it might well be that the month, but my interpretation is that it's 2020-2031. What authority do you have to grant extensions like that? And there is a, maybe I must not comment on that, I must not ask a question of that one now. I will do that probably tomorrow, later this afternoon. But lastly on this one, what is the cut-off date for this extension? Is it going to happen again and again and again? Or is there an intention to say, we can only do it up to this far? We're going to put a cut-off date to 2020 or 2025 or whatever the period. Okay. Okay, the DG would have to leave. I don't know whether the professor doesn't mind if we start with the DG. She has to leave.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, honourable members. I'm going to make a few comments based on the questions and ask my colleagues when I'm going to continue to provide responses to the
to the questions. Just one, firstly, Honorable Hadebe, the question, firstly, let me not start with that one. I wanted to talk to the first question that was raised by Honorable Perdin on the local authorities and their capacity. Unfortunately, the Constitution is the one that guides us on the role of the different spheres of government. In terms of Schedule 4, Part B of the Constitution, air pollution is a competence of municipalities. So national is providing a framework legislation, and hence the municipalities are even supposed to have bylaws that relate to air pollution and even waste to that in that respect. So the legislation, the reason why I'm starting there is because I think the Prof spoke about the law. We were changing law, which is APA of 1965, and trying to put a legislation that is more progressive, and therefore things that needed to change had to be undertaken progressively, because APA was licensing on processes. There was never ambient air quality standards in the country. So that is the first major change. And based on that change, one, we had to develop our own capacity as government. We used to have only one air quality officer, in fact, national air quality officer in the country in terms of APA. And that was the only person that was working, they were calling it CAPCO at the time, responsible for authorizations, for processes. And that was not taken into account, the kinds of impacts you would have on the environment broadly and even in terms of the health of society. So I think the context for this legislation was that, firstly, when the chair's question about declaration of the Highveld, at least I was already in the department as the chief director at the time, the work was fashioned on the basis of establishing evidence on what is existing to help us put together the legislation. And partly, normally when you prepare legislation, you either start with research. In this case, it was our input as part of the applied research, like we did with the other legislation. For example, on the greenhouse gases, we started with the long-term mitigation scenarios to understand the picture and the baseline. And the Prof had spoken to exactly what then informed how we were framing the legislation. So it is based on that. It does not answer all the questions, but the legislation can be strengthened with evidence that we then find as we progressively implement the law. So that is the first point. And secondly, legally, it is not, new laws do not apply retrospectively. So existing plants by right were designed in a certain fashion and they had a certain lifespan. And you had to fashion the transition on understanding, for example, for coal power plants, when would ESCOM particularly indicate when are they planning to either, what is this word of shutdown, not shutdown, decommission, because shutdown is a different word for power plants. Decommission certain plants because it is not economical for those plants to invest new technologies when in actual fact in 2020 or 2025 they are going to be closing down. So we had to take all of that information from all the industries into account. So this is what informs the base even for consideration of those postponement applications. All the department was doing was, when you even consider the requests or the applications, you have a public participation process, everybody that has got science
and information can come forward and present that data. Then we have a basis to use as evidence to say no on this because of A, B, C, D. We can justify where we have gaps in information. We also acknowledge that we have gaps in information. So that is just my contextual background to the answer. So the cost-benefit analysis, Honorable Hadebe, was not undertaken at the time of doing the legislation or putting together the legislation. However, there are models that the Prof was talking about in terms of projecting some of those costs. Health impacts, I understand, are different in terms of how you can determine. It is practically and scientifically, even in other countries of the world, not practical to say, Sasol, because of your plant here, this person is now suffering this type of a disease. However, we are building the system. Our focus on the 10 to 15, 20 years as a department, establish a system and evidence that could lead us to even succeed in those cases, because those matters would take us to a court process, even with some of the establishment. So my understanding from the department's posture is that we understand there would be health. We know the particles generally. If I breathe air with particulate matter, I am going to have health problems. The question is, where does that particulate matter come from? And what is the evidence that I can use to say it comes from Eskom, Sasol, or whoever? And we are then putting our system, and I think Thuli and the team can explain our monitoring system, how it is helping us, because before you only had these companies only having monitoring stations. We had to put and invest in infrastructure for municipalities, some of the local authorities. That infrastructure was funded by the national department, or we had donor partners that assisted with that investment. So we are still building the system, and we don't have a perfect system as yet as a department. And therefore, the issue of postponement applications does not lead to bad precedents at this point. And the key is that the law allows for those applications. We cannot just say willy-nilly now, no applications must come. We have to first go and amend legislation and say, based on this evidence, when we go through our public participation process, we need to have the scientific base to say, this is the basis for us to make those amendments. But currently, the law does not prohibit us considering the applications, which is why the applications are submitted to the department. It's the same thing like when you have to authorize any facility. The law allows for the authorities to receive the application. We can tighten some of the conditions as we improve on the knowledge that we use to base those decisions. Lastly, honorable members, on the view, I think Honorable Mkhunu, you were asking what is the view of the and the stance of the department on you on issue of a postponement application. And the department currently has to consider applications. Legally, we are obliged to consider all applications and have arrived at a decision through a rational process. That is what we are compelled to do. And I think the Thuli can explain the slides further. I take the point that not all the information is well explained. We have a memo that was provided to give the basis for outlining what is involved with the applications for postponement, but I think we can provide additional write-up to clarify some of the concepts that are involved in terms of the presentation. So my last response on the National Air Quality Officer, Honourable Patton, works with a team of people. We have the whole chief directorate and the DDG oversees the whole process. And the work, when the applications are received, there is data that is provided by the facilities. They look at all of that data with a team of people like this gentleman that was making the presentation here, Vumile, and a number of the other colleagues. You can say how many of the team. So there is a whole team. It's not a sole decision of just, but the air quality officer, because it's prescribed in law that it should be a person of this profession with these qualifications. I cannot sign those licenses because that delegation is given to the authority. Same with EIAs. We have what we call environmental impact practitioners, and we also talk or refer in our legislation to what we refer as consultants that are qualified and suitably qualified. Those are the people that are involved in decision making. But as the DG or the DDG of the department, we have oversight over that. But the technical aspects of that decision making is owned by those qualified officials. So she can actually be taken to court legally, so because of that responsibility that she holds. And then you'll clarify the limits. And lastly, the Honorable Makubela, on this issue of the dense and low-income settlements, what we did as a department in this progressive implementation of the legislation, the key assessment that came from the Highveld, and we did further studies on low-dense income settlements, and the scientific study says most of the people in those communities through burning are more exposed. So the strategy was already that we initiated some programs which involved teaching people, or at least creating awareness, working with the then Department of Energy. It was called Minerals and Energy at the time. We had programs where we're also phasing out certain types of stoves, and we had there were certain investments to be made so that you at least limit that close contact which affects people directly. And that strategy is what is being presented to Cabinet for decision, so that the issues around the potential for minimizing the exposure are dealt with at the point where that pollution is happening. The other pollution is happening, and there are dilution factors and other factors which would not necessarily directly be attributed to the source pollution to those individual families. However, we take into account some of the NGOs have written other work. I mean, we have seen the studies of the groundwork, I can't remember, but we have to subject those through our own rigorous scientific evaluations, because it is more about the evidence that is being utilized to then confirm how you deal with those aspects of the challenges that relate to the system. So we will improve the system in terms of what is the base for the decision-making processes continuously, to how we respond to compliance and enforcement. And I think when Frances was presenting, she was also outlining the technicalities that are involved when you then get to the actual enforcement. There are you have to do some toxicological studies that point to some of the transgressions that would have been found from a facility. But the fact that a facility exceeds the limit in terms of its permit condition, it is enough basis for us to take them through an enforcement action, and that is more of what we emphasize in the compliance and enforcement approach. So those are the comments that I thought I should make, honorable members, and certainly the system is not yet perfect, and hopefully it should mature. 10 years, we can show that there has been real progress. It is not big enough progress, but the fact that we have got a system with some technologies already invested in, the studies are already being initiated, but that study truly can outline the initial study that we undertook, because we also did not have all of the information that we'd use in terms of outlining health studies, and we needed to have the Department of Health as a partner in that respect. Let me hand over to Prof, then the team can come back. Thanks.
Okay, Prof.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I gave the impression that I was doing academic sums without regard for health impacts, then I must apologize. I put my presentation together in the wrong method then. This is exactly because we are concerned about health impacts that certain proposals were put on the table. The study that I refer to quantified health impacts. The reason for that is that we have to take a decision on a rational basis. And what one tries to do in these cost-benefit analysis is to exactly look at what the economic impact is of the health impacts of air pollution. That is actually the basis for a cost figure that was provided by CER as well. CER has also given us a figure which doesn't differ too much from the figure that was actually used in the study that I referred to, the cost of the health impact. What I try to do simply is to go a step further, to say one alternative of addressing the health impact is to put a blanket minimum emission standard compliance over the whole country, or at least over the major sources. All we did is to say, if we have to spend that sort of money, is there not a more cost-effective way where we can, for the same money, get a better mitigation of air pollution? Or get mitigation of air pollution at a reduced cost to the country? Because the first slide, the object of the Air Quality Act, is to provide good ambient air quality, taking into account social and economic development. So the cost-benefit analysis is simply an attempt to try to optimize mitigation of air pollution, if you will, to try to optimize the cost of air pollution mitigation. So in the specific study that I referred to, we were comparing the cost of mitigating air pollution, in other words, the cost of imposing the 2020 minimum emission standards, to the cost of the health benefit at ground level that would result from the imposition of those minimum emission standards. And in this case, it turned out that the cost is higher than the health benefit. And I fully agree, the colleagues from CER will say there's large uncertainty in your calculations, and I fully agree. If you look at the original paper, in fact we give a range of numbers. We say the health benefit is from so much to so much, and I believe CER actually used the same approach when calculating health cost. They say it is from here to there, because there is uncertainty in these calculations, especially because of the fact that we have to translate figures that were initially developed in the developed world, and we are trying to apply those figures to the South African conditions. So just finally, again, this is seriously not about making economic sums in an academic fashion that does not take people's health into regard. What we were trying to say is we have to obviously spend money on the air pollution problem. How best do we apply that money to give the largest benefit to the people in the dense, low income who suffer most and can least afford to take measures to reduce their own exposure. With regards to the Honorable Radebe's question, this was not about apportioning blame at all. We were not saying it is the people in the low-income residential areas' own fault that they are exposed to air pollution. We are fully aware, I think, that the poorest of the poor cannot afford at this stage different forms of energy than those that they are actually using. And therefore the proposal was that the department's draft strategy, Dr. Kumalo, I don't know whether it's a draft strategy or a strategy already, that draft strategy should be accelerated, in fact, and that the offsets that are allowed for in the offsets guideline should maybe be more specific to focus on persons that we know are most affected by air pollution, but can do on their own least about the pollution that they are exposed to. Then, and just one point, or 2 points in fact, you were asking about people that enter an industry and then come out sick. I don't think that was quite the purpose of this workshop, but occupational exposure is being considered under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. There's a different set of standards that apply to exposure in industry, because typically you have people between 18 and 60 there that you can expect to be healthy. They only work 8 hours a day in that environment. So they are not as exposed as the community is, but standards are applied, measurements are taken and reported to the Department of Labor about people's exposure in industry, so that is being addressed not under the Air Quality Act, but under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Then there was a question about, can we take job losses into account when we're doing all these cost-benefit analyses? I think that would be one step further than we can model at the moment, than we can calculate at the moment. What I understand the intent to be is, if we force a certain industry to meet certain emission standards and there are job losses, can we calculate what those job losses will cost? Unfortunately, I think that requires almost economy-wide modeling, which would be extremely difficult. Because there are other factors that affect job losses. It is not only the matter of imposing minimum emission standards. Chair, I hope that I have answered all the questions. If I have not, I would just like to be reminded of those that I omitted.
I think you did, Prof. But in addition to that, because you will be leaving, I'd wanted you to, or I would like you to also expand on the proposals that you make on the presentation that was distributed earlier. I think three areas here. One on the, you say the systematic revision of existing listed activities using the cost-benefit analysis, CBA. What do you mean by this one? And on the advisory committee, what do you mean by that, Prof? Then you talk about offset regulations. That could be made more specific. Can you expand on that? And then there is also a proposal on CBA to be included in the atmospheric impact report that is required for postponement application. Can you just expand on just this three item before, because I know we'll be breaking for lunch and then from there you'll be leaving.
Just
Chair, thank you. This is a bit embarrassing because I prepared a first version of the presentation and submitted a PDF version of that to the Secretariat, and then as one does, I thought a bit more about what I actually was saying and prepared the version of the presentation that you saw on the screen this morning. So what you are quoting from is the previous version of the presentation, which let's say contains some rash statements which I subsequently thought about and can explain to you if you allow me some time, but I subsequently thought not to be appropriate to this forum. But I can talk about some of them if you...
Yeah.
Okay. When the minimum emission standards were first put together, there was some discussion about a cost-benefit analysis on the minimum emission standards. In other words, in each case, to calculate what it would cost and what the benefit would be. But at the time when the Section 21 regulations were being drafted, there was simply not enough time to do this. We have, I think, in excess of 70 subcategories of minimum emission standards. And what one would have to do is for each of these subcategories to do this cost-benefit analysis, which is a hugely labor-intensive work to do. And at the time, there was simply no time to do this. What I was suggesting in the previous version of the presentation, that we might now be in a position where we can actually do that cost-benefit analysis and do a more systematic review of the minimum emission standards instead of simply taking the values from overseas and saying, well, we hope the same conditions apply in South Africa. But I am fully aware of how huge an undertaking this would be to do such a systematic cost-benefit analysis, and that is why I left it out of the version that you saw this morning. I think that it might be possible to include at least a simplified version of cost-benefit analysis in postponement applications, where we actually request the applicant of a postponement to at least give some idea of what the cost and benefits would be of the fact that he is applying for a postponement.
Which is currently not the case. Is it the case currently? The application...
The applicant has to supply an atmospheric impact report, which is a dispersion modeling exercise which says what will the ambient concentration be as a result of your postponement application. In other words, the fact that we allow you to continue higher emissions for a longer time, what will the impact of that be on ambient concentrations? That is what the atmospheric impact report does, that is required with each application. What I thought could be done is to, in addition to that atmospheric impact report, which goes halfway, to do a cost-benefit analysis based on that atmospheric impact report. And if we have to do that systematically for all the categories, that is really a large job. But if we at least can do it bit by bit with each postponement application, that might make some progress towards what we eventually would like to see. Then there was, I think, a question by yourself, sir, about the offsets. As I understand it, the offsets are a guideline at the moment, which do not contain quantitative targets for offsets and timelines for implementing those offsets. And the proposal in the previous version of the presentation was that possibly the department could work on providing these quantitative requirements of offsets and some timelines for implementation, which would make them, if you will, harder targets rather than soft targets. And then the advisory committee, I think I should go off the record here, but what happened in the original Air Quality Act, there was a proposal, or there is a section in the Air Quality Act that says the minister must appoint an advisory committee that was still under NEEF. You might remember the National Environmental Advisory Forum. And the original Air Quality Act said the minister must appoint an advisory subcommittee of NEEF to advise her on air quality matters. And there were, in fact, as far as I remember, there were nominations made, but the subcommittee, as far as I remember, was never appointed. Then the Air Quality Amendment Act came out. The Air Quality Act originally said the minister may. Then the Air Quality Amendment Act came out last year, I think, or the year before that, and that said the minister must appoint the subcommittee. And I said this might actually be a good idea because there is some air quality expertise out in the country, and you know that might be available for free to the minister. And then just recently the Environmental Acts Amendment Act came out, and that again made it optional for the minister to appoint an advisory committee. And that was the background to that remark in the original version of the presentation.
Okay, thanks, Prof. I see there are no hands for follow-up, so let's get the department to... Are there no hands for follow-up to the Prof? No hands. I'm not insisting that you must raise your hand. I was just checking whether there are hands. We need to break for lunch now. I'll give to Dr. Luyenge because he was not here when we asked for questions.
No, thanks, Chairperson. Mine is very short. It's around the usage of indigenous knowledge as it relates to pollution. There are methods that rural people and elderly people that they used before to actually make sure that the pollution of the air is actually fought using that particular expertise. So is there any method that is being used to utilize that? Thank you.
Chairperson, I'm sorry, but that question or the answer to that question is completely outside my field of knowledge, and I would be unable to answer that question.
I guess the department will attempt to do that. Honorable Khadev, you wanted to have a follow-up to the Prof?
Thank you, Chair. Actually, my follow-up question was directed to the DG, but I see she is not here. Actually, I was not having a gripe with the application for postponement, but what I was concerned about is that when the industry come and say, we will do 1, 2, and 3 in these 2 years, then all of a sudden they say, no, you gave us not enough time. Now we want to do it over a 5-year period. That seems to be a concern for me because that will happen more often when they say no. Initially, you gave us a permission to do 1, 2, and 3 for, like you just mentioned previously, that some of the industries, not that they can't meet minimum emission standards, that's the fact they don't do the proper maintenance of their units. So if you see someone is applying, then you recognize that he can do 1, 2, and 3 in the specific given time. You must stick to that. Don't allow to be bullied by industries in saying that no. Now we need 5 years because initially we thought we would do it in 2 years. That was my concern. If you agree with that and say we'll do it in 2 years, it must be 2 years. Not ask for further postponement. That,
okay.
I think, is clarifying my issue.
So there are questions for the department, for the three remaining officials of the department.
cite one example is the Sasol syn fuel in Gertsibande, where they asked for further postponement. Just to quote one example which was given on the presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Thuli.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. There is a list of questions, some of which the DG has addressed, so I will just take the gaps. Perhaps the first one for me is to go back to the offset guideline that the professor is referring to. The approach of the Air Quality Act is to work with targets. So we have a number that industries must comply with, and we have numbers for ambient air quality standards. And so the offset guideline has taken that approach of saying, this is what we want to achieve, and not over-prescribing for users how to get there. So I give an example. We have targets for sulfur dioxide, 50 milligrams from 2020 going forward. How the industry, which technology they choose and how they implement it, we don't get involved. And there are many historical reasons for that. One of them is that sometimes technology is manufactured according to a certain spec, and it may not achieve that in implementation. And we are not the manufacturers of those technologies. So if those technologies fail to meet the requirements, we cannot take responsibility for those technology failures. This is one example. So the way we've done it in the offset guideline as well is to set a target. So we've said, for example, for those facilities that we made a requirement for offset, we want you to address particulate matter pollution in this area. So we're specific in terms of the area. And then they do studies and implement technologies to reduce that particulate matter based on the major sources in the area. So, for example, in Zamdela area, the major source has been the burning of waste. In KwaZamokuhle, the major source is the burning of coal in people's homes. So because we are not prescribing, the industry then finds out what the major source is and they implement the offsets according to the need of that particular population. And I hope that when Sasol presents, they can discuss this at a detail. And the other thing, Chair, is that there are so many new developments that take place out there. I would see that we would have a problem if we were to prescribe. Can I give an example? We've industries have decided to insulate the homes so that they make them warmer and there's less requirement for extra heating. One of the things that happened when they started with that project, they installed ceilings in people's homes, but it was found that the roofs were leaking. When it rains, the water would come through and obviously the ceilings would rot and break and all of that. Then they made a further investigation and come out with a spray foam, which you spray on the corrugated iron. So it does both. It gives the insulation, but it also seals the holes that the rain would come through, which we didn't know as a department. So if we had said in our offset guideline, install ceilings, it wouldn't be a complete intervention because then the problem would be say, okay, now these things don't work and so on. I'm just giving an overall example on that. On the issue of the cost benefit of postponements, like the professor said, we don't have that as a requirement in the law, but the limits on the Section 21 minimum emission standards are technology based. So it's not so much what is required for us at the moment. The reality is that a boiler is made, and a boiler can achieve so much in terms of pollution abatement, and that's what informed those limits that we set. So it's not, obviously, boilers are made in Europe, so we'll take the number from the manufacturer that what the boiler can achieve. We don't manufacture locally, as much as I know. I think the point on saying enforcement of minimum emission standard is not the only measure to reduce pollution is correct, Chair. Like when I was presenting, I did mention some of the air pollution sources that we have in the country. And coming back to the strategy for addressing air pollution against low-income settlements, I have presented previously, the issue with that work is that even though the pollution, as opposed to an Eskom power plant to be specific, may be less. The problem is the exposure, because you make the fire in front of you and you breathe the pollution immediately as it is emitted, as opposed to a stack that may be 100 meters or 300 above the ground that emits the same amount of pollution but 20 kilometers away from where you are. In terms of the exposure, it is more significant. Not that the other one isn't. It's, I'm saying you breathe it immediately with no abatement whatsoever. And we have scientific studies where professors have measured in the person's house the same amount of carbon monoxide that you get at an ESCOM stack. And it is clear in terms of the impact how that would then, go. Which I would link to the question around indigenous knowledge, if I may. We have top-down ignition method for Mbaula, which is called Basanjongo Makoko, because Koko Mashinini is the person who helped the professors when they're coming up with that method to say, this is how best you make this fire. You put the wood first and then the paper and so on. So we do have indigenous knowledge, perhaps not to the extent that we would like, because at the end of the day, there are still scientific things around this. But we do take consultations from the community. That Basanjongo Makoko, that Koko that is referred to there is Koko Mashinini. And whenever we were putting pictures, we had pictures of her. And in one of the consultations we had at Tembisa, she came in person when Deputy Minister Mabuda Fancy was launching that Basanjongo Makoko interim measure, just to answer that one.
I missed the latter part of your submission.
I was saying, Chair, Koko Mashinini was with us when we had an event at Tembisa. And when we were showing people the Basanjongo Makoko top-down ignition method, she was present in person when the Deputy Minister was showing the communities that part of the work.
The part of which work of Koko Mashinini? I missed that part.
She's saying there's a way in which indigenous knowledge does deal with Mbaula burning. You first put wood and then paper, thereafter or something like that. So she's saying there's a person, the person who assisted the department in that regard is Koko Mashinini. And she was there with them in one event where these things were done. But probably it can be elaborated upon outside the meeting. But it's just that...
No, it must be elaborated in a meeting. Nothing outside.
Okay. No, I thought she was just mentioning in passing.
Answering a question there. Okay.
No, it's answered appropriately, Chair. Because generally, the most victims are the poor, and the poor resonates in rural areas. And this is not new. In the olden days, the elderly mamas and dadas, they had their own methods that seeks to fight against air pollution. That is actually culminating into them dying young. So these methods are there. Departments will always call for such knowledges to be brought about. Like if they use loamy soil to put up a stove to actually cook. And then if you do that with resources, you can make that much more better using the existing methods of maybe you have machines, you don't necessarily use the hand now. So that kind of knowledge is still there. But now, those people might not choose there, if you can look there, it's there on the screen. You can have those, those drums. You make those drums through putting together the type of soil that you have.
All right, can you proceed?
Thank you, Chair. Just that picture, the middle one to the right, is the one I'm talking about, the Mbaula. People were dying with the Mbaula that is on the right-hand side with a lot of smoke due to incomplete combustion. And in developing the other one, the scientists had the idea that if you start the fire from the top, there's, more complete combustion, and Google machine then assisted with how then you would make that fire burn, because obviously if you just put a match on the piece of code, it's not going to burn. That's just the example I was giving. The comment on the lack of flash on the slides for the trend, we provide additional information on that. And that information is not in the memo, because when we produced the memo, we were doing the postponements only. The request came later to include the equality trend. So we'll provide the full state of air of the country that we have presented at the Lohotla to give that understanding of how we have moved over time. There were different criteria used to grant the decisions and to decline those that were declined, as indicated in the presentation. But perhaps I can couple this response together with the questions around the team. I have a PhD in environmental science from the University of the Witwatersrand. I've got two other PhDs in the team. I have Dr. Vincent Kololo, please raise your hand so that they know, who's got a PhD in chemical engineering. I've got Dr. Kwaze, who helps us with the information management and dispersion modeling. Those are just the specialists, the two that we have. I also have a health specialist in the team. And then I've got four directors. One is Mr. Derek Makubele here, behind us, who's responsible for the authorization that the minister and the NACO are supposed to grant. And Vumile is a chemist. Well, Derek is a meteorologist by profession. Vumile is a chemist. His work helps us with the implementation of the AQUA. I have Tsiatsima Hema, who is also has a master's degree and helps us with the information management. All the monitoring stations across the country assist with that and has been instrumental in establishing the SAQIS, South African Equality Information System, together with Dr. Kwaze, that we have and are proud of. We can check the state of air right now in your phone. Also have Elizabeth Masekomang, who is assisting us with policies and regulations and planning in that regard, has an MSc from Toronto, Canada. That's just, you know, I'm talking only about the management team. I've got other people in the team, highly qualified, but our expertise is not limited to what exists in the team. We have consultation processes. We have partnerships with different universities, with professors like Herit. Cornelius here, who actually, in his presentation, indicated how he made input in the development of the standards. He is also, over and above that, a chemical engineer himself, qualified, and other expertise exists out there. So I believe that in South Africa, as it is, as a country, we have very skillful people. And I'm confident that with the capacity we have within and outside the department is sufficient. We work with the CSIR from time to time, different, you know. So in terms of capacity, I'm not worried about that. But even after that, some of the problems we have in South Africa are uniquely ours. So even with all those expertise, we still need to sit with everybody around the table and develop unique solutions. So if I can take the dense strategy, for example, in London, when they had smog, everybody was burning coal in their homes. They passed a law that said from today onwards, no more burning of coal, and they could. We can't do that because we criminalize more than half the population, perhaps, if we say it is a criminal offense to burn coal in your home from today onwards. So the way to do that is to work together as a collective and say, what strategies can you implement for us in our country to achieve those objectives of equality that we have? Hence, we have strategies of vehicles as well, because most of those problems are socioeconomic issues. A brand new Mercedes-Benz, for example, will not give you pollution as an old Datsun. So what do you say to Babu Mabuza, who owns the Datsun? Never drive again into the city? It's a problem. So you need, you know, different strategies to address our problems that we face in the country. I will leave that one on why some of the units have different targets to Vincent. You can talk to it on the engineering space. In terms of capacity, the district municipalities and the metros around the function of equality, I would say this is a shifting target, because we have seen capacity, you know, being built in some of the municipalities. But the reality is that we are not, in some cases, able to retain those people when they have developed those skills. Somebody comes with a better offer and they're gone to industry or wherever. So we keep having to go back and build capacity. In some of the municipalities, we have real problems. and we've presented this to MINTEC and NIMEC, and the instruction we've been given is to work with provinces so that they can take over the function of licensing where there are major problems. And as a working group too, which is responsible for air quality management in the country, are going to look into how best to do that. But the reality is that we do have capacity problems in different areas, and perhaps Francis' presentation touched a bit on that, on the work that they do in compliance monitoring and enforcement to build the capacity or to even intervene directly in some cases and deal with the compliance issues as they were. Okay. I think the critical question is around the air pollution trends since the declaration of the priority areas. And I will agree, we have not reached compliance in most of the stations that we want. But we have seen improvements. And the reality is that these problems were created over a 40-year period. It would be good to resolve them in 2 days, but in reality, it's impossible. We are working on it. We are seeing reductions. If you look at the emission profiles from some of the industries, they've come down quite a lot from where they were before the legislation was put in place. The valve, for example, used to have a dark red cloud of dust from ArcelorMittal. And after they had implemented the bag house, we've seen an improvement, even in when you look with the naked eye. So yes, we have seen improvements. They have not reached compliance. That is why we are still in the area working. And this is not a new thing. In Europe, in the US, because that's where we look, obviously there's no such capacity within the continent. It also took them a number of years to reach the compliance levels that they are at right now. And when you look at the UK slide, for example, there are clear policy interventions that came into place. So if I can make a broad example, if we shifted in South Africa, our reliance, at least a percentage of it, on burning coal to generate electricity, we would see immediate improvement in ambient air. That is a no-brainer. Also, when you look at the cities at the moment in the state of air, when we're looking at it this year, there is increasing strain because of increased vehicle emissions. And some of the policy interventions that we need as a country are bold statements like we did with the World Cup, park and ride. Should we go that route where we say, no more driving into the cities? Everybody who has a car, you will park your car here and get into a bus. It goes on these streets to get to your office. Those are some of the things that we need to be looking at, because the vehicle population is growing. The population is growing. Not so many countries have population growing at 25% like we have in South Africa. And the reality is that those things put pressure on the environmental system. And we need, as a country, to start looking at that. We have seen, unfortunately, improvements in the Highveld when some of the steel plants shut down and came off. For economic reasons, not just Evraz, that was a non-compliance issue. We measured improvements in the air. We want improvements in the air, but without the job losses, you know, that come with economically it's no longer viable to run this plant. But you see that as a proxy. The scientists in their own independent work have showed us that finally, these later years, we have started decoupling our economic growth from the SO2 emissions, which means even though SO2 emissions have stagnated and started going down, the economy has continued to grow, which is a promising scenario for the country, because it means, like other countries like China, they've grown their economy even though their pollution was going down. So we can do it too if we have the right policy shift going forward. On the issue of the advisory committee for the minister, yes, Professor Herit, it has changed again to a May. And the reason for that change was that air quality as a science has got very diverse specialities within it. And if a minister wanted to address a certain problem, she would need a different group of people. So for example, if she wants to address industrial emissions, obviously Professor Herit will be part of that team. But if she wanted to address the issue of traffic emissions or indigenous knowledge, like the question came, she would need a different group of people. So it's a May, so that as her need arises, she would then appoint the committee for the problem that she wants to address, as opposed to having a standing committee that, because we don't have a one-size-fits-all. Like I say, in the team that I have right now, I have people who are writers, I have engineers, different types of engineers, because it is an array of expertise that you need to address these problems. So it's still there, the minister may, but discretionary. When she has a specific problem to address, she will appoint those specific people, and legal services works with us to determine those things, which, yeah. I think the other one from Honorable Ateb around why we have granted postponements again. The issue is, I mean, there are a lot of reasons people apply for postponements. If I can use the example of Shell Total and them, they're moving to the IDZ in the PE that they're moving to, which project is a project of Transnet to have the storage facility ready for all the refineries. And so they needed a postponement until the time that they would move from where they are in the different locations to the IDZ, which would be better emissions control for us actually going forward. But then Transnet project was delayed, so they were no longer going to move at the time that they had said they would move. So when then they came back, because now they are not able to. We granted the postponement again with the proviso that if by the 2020, I think it was, they don't move to the IDZ, they will comply anyway where they are, because it means the move is no longer happening. So it's different. Like, there's not one reason that postponements are granted. In some instances, the technology needs to be designed. It's unlike where the technology exists, it can be bought and you know, implemented in a certain context. The designing for technology for a plant that was built in the 40s that never had allowance for the technology in the first place would obviously take a longer period of time than a plant that was built, you know, in recent years that could easily, even if the technology is not fitted, but could easily be adapted to fit with that technology. That's why, you know, it is difficult to have one, you know, size-fits-all approach for these postponements, because there are different valid reasons. And of course, people do take advantage of the law. We had, I think, was it Shell that said, there are international people didn't approve their procurement processes, and we're like, no, but that's a business decision. You tell international people this is a license to operate in the Republic, they must make it happen. Where it is just taking a chance, we don't allow that. But in some cases, it is really significant reasons that people cannot come into compliance at the date that they had envisaged they would come into compliance. I think, Chair, we are having a discussion in the department, and it's not finalized around this community as to whether we will be able to change the law to address it the way we have seen it, because obviously, it was there in the law so that people could invest and come into it as a postponement. But with the reality, again, with that, is that there are facilities that may never be able to come into compliance. And the only solution for those facilities is to decommission and come out of the system altogether. You would, therefore, as the Act requires us to be reasonable, treat such facility different from a facility that has no plan to come out of the system, has a longer period of time to operate and contribute to the pollution problem, but it is a conversation that is still developing in the department, and the decision has not yet been made on how to deal with that. I think I've addressed everything. Oh, there was another one that says, do we believe everything that we have been told by industry? I think we operate in a clear and straightforward legal framework. First of all, it's an offense to give false information to the equality officer, and those who've done that have obviously regretted it. But we do have ways of checking the checks and balances, even the legal framework itself. A scientist has to be qualified, and you put your head on the table when you do these studies. So we don't believe everything, but we do have the expertise available to us, even outside the department, to tap into that and see whether what is being presented to us is correct or not. For example, the cleaning up, sometimes it's just a matter of improving efficiency in the plant that you can come into compliance. We are able to make the determination around those imperatives.
Okay, I think we must complete answering questions when we're at that side after lunch.
lunch has been ready from 1 o'clock. So I think we are going to break. If there are other responses that you still need to give, we will do that immediately after lunch. I think the issue of postponement till when, it's a matter that we still need to discuss. because postponement must be treated as an exception. It should not be...